Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 471, titled Death Trap, being recorded on August 1st of the year 2004. We're going to plunge right in here and continue with the line of inquiry that we've been developing on Side 1 and really in many programs before that, namely that this administration is deliberately out to destroy the United States economically, politically, diplomatically, and if need be, physically, in order to basically eliminate American democracy. I believe this administration is a front for the underground Reich that is also using proxy warriors from the Muslim population of the Earth Island as external combatants while the Bush administration destroys this country economically, militarily, and diplomatically from within. Classic Nazi fifth column activity. We're going to take a look now at an article that develops still further one of the points that we were making in Side 1, namely that Osama bin Laden couldn't have asked for a better ally than George Bush, and that the invasion of Iraq actually is one of the best things that could have happened to al-Qaeda, to Osama bin Laden, because it has broadened the appeal of al-Qaeda from just being a limited organization to being an ideology. The following is from Mother Jones Magazine's issue of July and August of 2004. This article is called Backdraft, subtitled How the War in Iraq Has Fueled Al-Qaeda and Ignited Its Dream of Global Jihad. It's by Peter Bergen, and it reads as follows. President Bush's May 2003 announcement aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln that major combat operations, unquote, had ended in Iraq has been replayed endlessly. What's less well remembered is just what the president claimed the United States had accomplished, quote, "The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001, he declared. The defeat of Saddam Hussein, he told the American people, was, quote, a crucial advance in the campaign against terror, unquote. In fact, the consensus now emerging among a wide range of intelligence and counterterrorism professionals is that the opposite is true. The invasion of Iraq not only failed to help the war on terrorism, but it represented a substantial setback. In more than a dozen interviews, experts both within and outside the U.S. government laid out a stark analysis of how the war has hampered the campaign against al-Qaeda. Not only, they point out, did the war divert resources and attention away from Afghanistan, seriously damaging the prospects of capturing al-Qaeda leaders, but it has also opened a new front for terrorists in Iraq and created a new justification for attacking Westerners around the world. Perhaps most important, it has dramatically speeded up the process by which al-Qaeda, the organization, has morphed into a broad-based ideological movement, a shift, in effect, from bin Laden to bin Ladenism. Quote, if Osama believed in Christmas, this is what he'd want under his Christmas tree, unquote, one senior intelligence official told me. Another counterterrorism official suggests that Iraq might begin to resemble Afghanistan 1996, unquote, a reference to the year that bin Laden seized on Afghanistan, a chaotic failed state, as his new base of operations. Even Kenneth Pollack, one of the nation's leading experts on Iraq, whose book The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, made the most authoritative case for overthrowing Saddam Hussein, says, quote, my instinct tells me that the Iraq war has hindered the war on terrorism. You had to deal with al-Qaeda first, not Saddam. We had not crippled the al-Qaeda organization when we embarked on the Iraq war, unquote. Recall that in Side 1 I reiterated a point that I've made several times, namely that there are substantive indications, not that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein had a cooperative relationship, but they had arrived at an understanding whereby al-Qaeda would function as a doomsday backup unit to Saddam Hussein in the event that the Americans invaded and overthrew him. Of course, that is exactly what happened, and I believe that that is a trap that we walked into. Continuing. The damage to U.S. interests is hard to overestimate. Rohan Gunaratne, a Sri Lankan academic who is regarded as one of the world's leading authorities on al-Qaeda, points out that sadness and anger about Iraq, even among moderate Muslims, is being harnessed and exploited by terrorist and extremist groups worldwide to grow in strength, size, and influence, unquote. Similarly, Vincent Canestraro, a former chief of counterterrorism at the CIA under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush, says the Iraq War, quote, accelerated terrorism, unquote, by, quote, metastasizing, unquote, al-Qaeda. Today, al-Qaeda is more than the narrowly defined group that attacked the United States on September 11, 2001. It's a growing global movement that has been energized by the war in Iraq. This turn of events is a dramatic shift from the mood in the months following the 9/11 attacks. When the United States went to war against the Taliban, it was understood by many in the global community, including many Arabs and Muslims, as a just war. The war in Iraq not only drained that reservoir of goodwill, it also dragged the United States into what many see as a conflict with the Muslim world, or Ummah in general. Samer Shahata, a professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University, says the Iraq war has convinced, quote, many Muslims around the world, perhaps a majority, that the war on terrorism is in fact a war against Islam, unquote. Jason Burke, author of the authoritative 2003 book Al-Qaeda, Casting a Shadow of Terror, adds that the Iraq war, quote, appears to be clear evidence to many that the perception of the militants is in fact accurate and that the Ummah is engaged in a war of self-defense. This has theological implications. Jihad is compulsory for all Muslims if the Ummah is under attack. This is not an arcane matter of Islamic jurisprudence, but a key reason why Americans are now dying in significant numbers in Iraq, and an important factor behind the rise of a revitalized Al-Qaeda movement. The Quran has two sets of justifications for holy war. One concerns a defensive jihad when a Muslim land is under attack by non-Muslims, while the other countenances offensive attacks on infidels. Generally, Muslims consider the defensive justification for jihad to be the more legitimate. It was, for instance, a defensive jihad that clerics invoked against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan during the 1980s. To the extent that Sunni Muslims, the vast majority of Muslims, have a Vatican, it is Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the preeminent center of Muslim thought. Before the Iraq War, Al-Azhar released a fatwa, a ruling on Islamic law, to the effect that if crusader, unquote, forces attacked Iraq, it was an obligation for every Muslim to fight back. The clerics of Al-Azhar were not alone in this view. The prominent Lebanese Shiite scholar Sheikh Fadlullah also called on Muslims to fight American forces in Iraq. In contrast, after 9/11, Sheikh Fadlullah had issued a fatwa condemning the attacks, as did the chief cleric of Al-Azhar. Throughout the Muslim world, leading clerics who had condemned what happened on 9/11 have given their blessings to fighting against the occupation of Iraq, and as demonstrated by the attacks in Madrid in March, jihadists are prepared to take that fight to the invaders' home turf. Harry Skip Brandon, a former senior counterterrorism official at the FBI, says the Iraq war serves as a real rallying point, not only for the region, but also in Asia. We've seen very solid examples of them using the Iraq war for recruiting. I've seen it personally in Malaysia. If the Iraq war is a public relations bonanza for Al-Qaeda and a public relations disaster for us, the longer it goes on, unquote. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's prediction that the occupation of Iraq would create, quote, 100 bin Ladens, unquote, is beginning to look prescient. We may soon find ourselves facing something akin to a global intifada. Perhaps the most emblematic failure of the war on terrorism has been the continued ability of Al-Qaeda's top leaders, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, to set the agenda for a string of terrorist attacks around the world. A bin Laden call for attacks against Western economic interests in October of 2002 was followed by bombings of a French oil tanker and a Bali disco catering to Western tourists. By the way, I would note that call by bin Laden to attack Western economic interests in October 2002 is well worth taking note of. As we discussed in For the Record 412, titled The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train, the Financial Times of London has editorialized that the Bush administration and its allies in Congress, whom they termed, quote, right-wing radicals, unquote, very strong language for the editorial page of the Financial Times, that they had deliberately run up the deficits and were intending to create a fiscal train wreck, unquote, in order to force fundamental changes on American society. Note, again, the confluence between what bin Laden wanted and what this administration is doing, and note that the point men for the Republican Party's tax-cutting mania, which is one of the things that's placed us in the sea of red ink that we're in, people like Karl Rove and Grover Norquist are the same people who formed the Islamist link to the Republican Party through its ethnic outreach branch, and specifically there are significant elements of overlap between elements accused of funding Al-Qaeda, the bank Al-Taqwa, and the Republican Party and Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute. Continuing, in September 2003, Zawahiri denounced Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf for supporting the U.S. campaign against Al-Qaeda. Musharraf narrowly survived two assassination attempts over the months that followed. And after bin Laden called for retaliation against countries that were part of the coalition in Iraq in late 2003, terrorists attacked an Italian police barracks in Iraq, a British consulate in Turkey, and commuter trains in Madrid. According to a May report by the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, al-Qaeda is now fully reconstituted, unquote, with a new and effective modus operandi, unquote, a presence in as many as 90 countries and over 18,000 potential terrorists still at large, unquote. Yet despite al-Qaeda's undiminished global influence, the United States has pulled vital resources away from the hunt for bin Laden and Zawahiri. Soon after the fall of the Taliban, substantial numbers of Arabic speakers at the CIA and the National Security Agency were directed to focus on Iraq rather than the hunt for al-Qaeda. Quote, by January 2002, serious planning began for the invasion of Iraq, notes Canestraro, the former CIA counterterrorism chief, again quoting, and that meant drawing down Arabic language resources from CIA and electronic intelligence gathering, unquote. In addition, says Richard Clark, who headed counterterrorism efforts under both Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush, unmanned Predator spy planes were deployed away from Afghanistan to Iraq in March of 2003, and satellites surveying the Afghan-Pakistani border were diverted to the Gulf region. Special operations soldiers with critical skills, including Arabic language training, were perhaps the U.S. military's key asset in the effort to capture al-Qaeda leaders. But according to Larry Johnson, who used to work on counterterrorism issues at the CIA and State Department, and who now advises the U.S. military on terrorism, those forces were pulled out of Afghanistan in the spring of 2002 to look for Scud missiles in western Iraq. It was only following the capture of Saddam Hussein last December that those troops were directed back to searching for al-Qaeda, leaving the pursuit of al-Qaeda's leaders significantly impaired for a year and a half. Today, the hunt for al-Qaeda and Taliban in Afghanistan is largely a waiting game. Last summer, when I went out with a platoon from the 82nd Airborne on a mission into the Badlands along the Afghan border to look for al-Qaeda and other anti-coalition forces, I found that the three-day mission did little more than chase shadows. Sergeant Joe Frost, a demolitions expert in his mid-30s, summed it up by noting that U.S. troops often found themselves attacked after sundown, but could rarely find their assailants. Quote, they're like shoot and run. We've seen one al-Qaeda person in the last 6 months, unquote. And therein lies the crux of the problem. The United States did not effectively crush al-Qaeda forces in Afghanistan during the war and its aftermath, which meant that those forces were able to slip away into the border region where they can hide and organize attacks both inside Afghanistan and around the world. Today, only 20,000 U.S. troops are stationed in Afghanistan, a country the size of Texas and nearly 50% larger than Iraq, where 140,000 U.S. troops haven't been enough to create stability. Kathy Gannon, who has covered Afghanistan for the past 16 years for the AP, says that the security situation is as bad as it's ever been, unquote, and that includes the years during and before the Taliban regime. The power of regional warlords has surged, challenging Hamid Karzai's central government and creating space for the Taliban to quietly emerge from the shadows. Taliban leader Mullah Omar and military commander Jalaluddin Haqqani both remain at large, as does Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a Pashtun warlord whose forces are regularly engaging U.S. soldiers. Meanwhile, Afghanistan has become the world's largest source of opium, the raw material for heroin. The country is now one of the world's leading narco states, and money from the $2.3 billion drug trade is reportedly making its way into al-Qaeda's coffers. According to Barnett Rubin, a senior fellow at New York University and an authority on the region, Afghanistan is, quote, obviously in danger of reverting to a failed state, unquote. But the administration's focus on the war in Iraq has not only caused it to shortchange the hunt for al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, it has also undermined the war on terrorism around the world. A poll taken by the Pew Global Attitudes Project in March 2004 found that bin Laden is viewed favorably by large parts of the population in Pakistan, 65%, Jordan, 55%, and Morocco, 45%, all countries that are key allies in the war on terrorism. The results echo those of a Pew survey taken shortly after the invasion of Iraq, in which Indonesians, Jordanians, Turks, and Moroccans all expressed more confidence, unquote, in bin Laden than in President Bush. During the build-up to the war, the polling company Zogby International found that favorable views of the United States had declined from 34 to 10% in Jordan, 38 to 9% in Morocco, and 12 to 3% in Saudi Arabia. Of course, admiration for bin Laden and dislike for the United States do not necessarily translate it into a desire to attack Westerners. But the war against bin Laden is in large part a war of ideas, and on that front, the war in Iraq has damaged the United States' cause and broadened the pool of al-Qaeda recruits. Nowhere is this shift more visible than on the Internet, a significant fact in itself, since the Internet chatter reflects the opinions of a relatively educated elite segment of the Muslim world. To the extent that al-Qaeda, the base in Arabic, has a new base, it is to a surprising degree on the web. According to a U.S. government contractor who specializes in analyzing jihadist chat rooms and websites, web traffic was, quote, tremendously energized, unquote, in the period before the Iraq War. When it was clear that the war was about to occur, there was more participation, more rhetoric, and more anger, unquote, the contractor says, again quoting, the war in Afghanistan provoked some anger, but not as much as the Iraq War, unquote. And while such chatter often amounts to mere venting, online discussions can also generate a roadmap for terrorist acts. Veteran Middle East reporter Paul Edel, who closely monitors Arabic language websites, points to a document posted on the al-Qaeda site in December 2003, quote, reflecting the thinking of senior al-Qaeda leaders, unquote, that discussed how to best break up the coalition in Iraq. The document noted that countries like the United Kingdom were unlikely to withdraw from Iraq, while Spain was the weakest link in the coalition. 3 months later, 191 Spaniards lost their lives in a bombing timed to coincide with Spain's election, and Spain subsequently withdrew its troops from Iraq. Another shift in Internet traffic came this spring when visits to websites with information about Iraq, such as Al Jazeera's homepage, skyrocketed during the standoff in Fallujah and the prison abuse scandal. Quote, Iraq has become transformed beyond a cause that energized just the jihadists, Edel says. It has caused outrage at every middle-class dinner table in the Middle East, unquote. Saddam Hussein's Iraq, despite the administration's arguments to the contrary, was hardly a haven for al-Qaeda. But now, Iraq has become what some experts call a super magnet, unquote, for jihadists. We've created the World Series of Terrorism, a senior government counterterrorism official told me. Judith Yaffe, who was the CIA's senior analyst on Iraq during the first Gulf War, says Iraq is, quote, open to terrorism in a way that it was not before. The lack of central authority makes it more amenable to terrorists, unquote. Iraq is convenient for Arab militants who can blend into its society in a way they did not in Bosnia, Chechnya, or Afghanistan. Dr. Saad al-Faghi, a leading Saudi dissident, says that hundreds of Saudis have gone to fight in Iraq. One source of his, he says, compares Iraq to Peshawar during the 1980s, a reference to the Pakistani city that attracted Muslims from around the world seeking to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. Given that large numbers of U.S. forces are likely to be in Iraq for years, it's clear that the country will remain an important theater of operations for al-Qaeda and its affiliates. The irony of this development hardly needs to be stated. A key reason the Bush administration was able to sell the Iraq War to the American people was the widely held belief that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's regime had entered into an unholy alliance and were jointly responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, something 2 out of 3 Americans believed, according to a Pew poll released in October 2002. To date, the largest criminal investigation in history has turned up no evidence of Iraq's involvement in 9/11, nor have the occupation of Iraq and the efforts of the entire U.S. intelligence apparatus uncovered any such link. Yet al-Qaeda-like groups, both homegrown and foreign, have now become well-established in Iraq. Quote, prior to 2003 and our invasion, Iraq rarely figured on the international terrorism charts, notes Larry Johnson, the military advisor. Now, Iraq has had the third largest number of terrorist fatalities after Israel and India, unquote. Nor has the Iraqi flypaper served to stop jihadists from attacking elsewhere. Over the past year, more than 100 people have died in attacks against Western and Jewish targets in Turkey and Morocco. Car bombs in Saudi Arabia have killed scores more. A suicide attacker in August 2003 bombed a Marriott hotel in Indonesia, killing 12, and the train bombs in Madrid left 191 people dead. And these numbers do not take into account the thousands of people who have been killed in the past year in insurgencies in places such as Kashmir, Chechnya, Uzbekistan, Thailand, the Philippines, and Indonesia, all conflicts in which the broader al-Qaeda movement plays a significant role. Which brings us to an important question. What is al-Qaeda? The network is perhaps best understood as a series of concentric rings growing more ill-defined as they spread outward. At the core is al-Qaeda, the organization which bin Laden and a dozen or so close associates formed in 1989, and which eventually expanded to 200 to 300 core members who have sworn an oath of allegiance to bin Laden, their emir or prince. It was al-Qaeda, the organization, that attacked the United States on September 11, 2001. The second concentric ring consists of perhaps several thousand men who have been trained in al-Qaeda's Afghan camps in bomb-making, assassination, and the manufacturing of poisons. Beyond that ring are as many as 120,000 who received some kind of basic military training in Afghanistan over the past decade. An undetermined number of these fighters are now sharpening their skills as insurgents from Kashmir to Algeria. The Madrid attacks in March are emblematic of what is emerging as the fourth and perhaps most ambiguous and potentially most dangerous ring in the al-Qaeda galaxy. The attacks were carried out by a group of Moroccans with few links to al-Qaeda, the organization. Some of the conspirators did try to establish direct contact with the inner core of al-Qaeda, but that effort appears to have been unsuccessful, and they carried out the attacks under their own steam. These attacks may well represent the future of, quote, al-Qaeda, unquote, operations, most of which will be executed by local jihadists who have little or no direct connection to bin Laden's group. Skipping down. What we have done in Iraq is what bin Laden could not have hoped for in his wildest dreams. We invaded an oil-rich Muslim nation in the heart of the Middle East, the very type of imperial adventure that bin Laden has long predicted was the United States' long-term goal in the region. We deposed the secular socialist Saddam, whom bin Laden has long despised, igniting Sunni and Shia fundamentalist fervor in Iraq, and have now provoked a defensive, unquote, jihad that has galvanized jihad-minded Muslims around the world. It's hard to imagine a set of policies better designed to sabotage the war on terrorism. And I would suggest that that is exactly the goal. Very quickly, we're going to review some information I presented in other broadcasts, including, for the record, 372, 412, and 441. Again, my comparison between the power elite of the United States and the power elite of France, which, due to ideological and economic connections to the Third Reich, deliberately subverted their own countrymen. And that's why the military resistance of the French against the Germans in World War II collapsed so precipitously. Reviewing some information from the book Triumph of Treason, authored by Pierre Coe, who was the French Minister of Aviation under the Popular Front of Léon Blum. This book was published in hardcover by Ziff Davis and copyright 1944. Talking about how the Fifth Column deliberately subverted the French military resistance to Hitler in World War II. And again, I'm not talking about the resistance per se. I'm talking about why France collapsed so quickly after the Germans invaded. Why? Because they detested the Republican democracy more than they loved France. They accepted the idea of the defeat as a necessary evil which permitted them to rid France of the democratic system and to keep in power in the neighboring countries the fascist dictators whom they considered solely capable of maintaining order in Europe. They afterwards became unconscious collaborators of these dictators. They thought they were doing their duty in letting Hitler free France from the Judeo-Masonic influence and Europe from the leftist communist peril. These people who had never read Marx considered the Marxist danger, unquote, more immediate than the Hitlerian. They preferred the risks of an entente with a victorious Hitler to the risks of a democratic victory that would cause the collapse of the fascist dictators in Europe. Considering Hitler in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, and Franco in Spain as knights of an anti-Bolshevist crusade, they became precursors and later partisans of collaboration with Hitler's new order. Enough evidence has been published already to prove that France was stabbed in the back by those who saw in Hitler the new Saint George who would slay the communist dragon, or the progressive dragon in the United States, updating the argument. Continuing, when Pierre Lazareff, former editor-in-chief of Paris Soir, the French newspaper with the widest circulation, reports royalists as saying, "We need the defeat to wipe out the Republic," when Elie Bois, the former editor of the Petit Parisien, the most influential political newspaper, reports great industrialists as admitting to him during the winter of 1939-40 that a plot had been organized to replace the democratic regime by a government of authority, unquote, and that this plot presupposed a Nazi victory. When Anatole de Monzy writes in a book passed by the censor of the Vichy government that Maréchal Pétain said in February of 1940, quote, "They will appeal to me in the third week in May," unquote. When Geneviève Tabouy tells of the work accomplished in the Parisian salons by the 5th Column's Brigade Mondaine, when Henri de Carilis, former officer and nationalist deputy, exposes the inroads of the 5th Column in the conservative and military circles which he knew, when Henri Torres reveals to us what was going on in the offices of the official propaganda, we have every reason to affirm their affirmations, which tally so perfectly with the events. Reviewing an item that we looked at last week toward the end of the broadcast, this concerns the new traditionalist movement being advocated by Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich advocated that the Christian right and conservatives in general step aside and begin building their own institutions. And in an article quoted from Catherine Eureka's website, this in turn, an article from the American Prospect Incorporated, it turns out that what Weyrich and his folks really had in mind was less separatism than guerrilla warfare. A new traditionalist movement that, according to its manifesto, written by Weyrich protege Eric Hubeck and bearing the grandiose title The Integration of Theory and Practice, a program for the new traditionalist movement, would seek to advance a true traditionalist counterculture based on virtue, excellence, and self-discipline. Skipping down. "We will not try to reform existing institutions. We only intend to weaken them and eventually destroy them. We will endeavor to knock our opponents off balance and unsettle them at every opportunity." And again, bearing in mind how the French reactionaries, the Fifth Column in France, saw a Nazi military victory as an essential element for overthrowing the Republic. Also reviewing from last week an article that originally appeared in Cigar Aficionado magazine, an interview with Tommy Franks, the former head of the U.S. Central Command, who voiced his fears. A man, by the way, whom I respect, and a Democrat. This is from originally Cigar Aficionado magazine. This is from John O. Edwards of the Newsmax.com conservative website. "General Tommy Frank says that if the United States is hit with a weapon of mass destruction that inflicts large casualties, the Constitution will likely be discarded in favor of a military form of government." Skipping down. In the magazine's December edition, the former commander of the Military Central Command warned that if terrorists succeeded in using a weapon of mass destruction against the U.S. or one of our allies, it would likely have catastrophic consequences for our cherished Republican form of government. And indeed, I think that combination of deliberately stoking the terrorist inferno as at the same time as subverting the American economy by drowning it in a sea of red ink, they are doing exactly to the United States what the French fascist fifth columnists did in the run-up to and during World War II. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 471, titled Death Trap, being recorded on August 1st of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.